Hello, and welcome to another edition of New Books in Systems and Cybernetics, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Tom Scholt, from the University of British Columbia. The cybernetics community owes a great debt of thanks to the editors of Routledge Library Edition's Philosophy of Mind series for bringing to light a neglected classic of the field in 2015. It was then that their reprint of Kenneth Sayre's Cybernetics and the Philosophy of Mind appeared. Originally published in 1976, Sayre's book proffers cybernetics as nothing less than a solution to the mind-body problem through a kind of informational monism reminiscent of the thought of Gregory Bateson. As such, it provides as fulsomely developed a cybernetic theory as one is likely to find anywhere, one that most certainly deserves a place in the canon of the field's most substantial works. In my in-depth conversation with Dr. Sayre, now Professor Emeritus of Philosophy at Notre Dame University, we explore the relationship between the two entropies of information theory and thermodynamics, parse the notion of feedback into even more fine-grained categories of homeostatic, heterotelic, sentient, and anticipatory, and trace the role of these various types of feedback in processes of evolutionary adaptation, behavioral conditioning, and consciousness, as well as the development of social structures, language, and reasoning, leading to the maximization of negentropic flexibility. The result is a deeply thought-provoking glimpse of a rigorously argued cybernetic framework deserving of considerable attention within and beyond the field. And so, without any further ado, let's turn to my conversation with Kenneth Sayre. Dr. Kenneth Sayre, thank you so much for taking the time to join us on New Books in Systems and Cybernetics. It's a great honor to have you with us.
It's my privilege. I appreciate it very much.
So first of all, congratulations on the reissue of the book. This book initially came out in 1975, correct?
76.
76, yeah. Well, it's obviously a well-deserved reprint, and I'm certainly very, very grateful for it because I don't know if I would have discovered it, and it's certainly enriched my ongoing study of the field. So congratulations, and I'm very grateful that your book has been made available to us again, deservedly so, and that you're here with us. So
thank you.
Yeah. So as is traditional for all the channels on the New Books Network, we just start with a general question. Can you tell us a little bit about your academic background and your intellectual journey to an engagement with cybernetics?
Right. I have a bachelor's degree in mathematics. In 1952. I have a PhD in philosophy in 1958. While I was working on my PhD thesis, I had a full-time job with MIT's Lincoln Laboratory, which was then engaged in defense contracts. We were working on what was known as the SAGE system, S-A-G-E, semi-automatic ground environment, which was basically a system in which human tasks were taken over, when feasible, by computer, by machines, as it were. An early version of artificial intelligence before that name became part of the public domain. At Lincoln Laboratory, while working with SAGE, there were a number of people that were very influential in my subsequent development. Two well-known people at Lincoln Laboratory at the time were Oliver Selfridge, Marvin Minsky, whom I got to know, a person that some of your listeners and you perhaps may have heard of, but may not, was Fred Fredkin, Alfred Fredkin, who was one of the three scientists covered in a book by Robert Wright named Three Scientists and Their Gods. The other two were E.O. Wilson and Shoemaker. Fredkin and I were office mates. We spent a lot of time together, got to know him very well, and we fed each other's interests. Among those interests, incidentally, was playing Go. That's where I learned to play Go, and well, you go with another topic, but you may be familiar with the recent developments in the last few years of what was called, what, Deep Blue or something?
That's right. Yes.
The computer that beat the best of the world's Go players.
Yes.
And at one point, we had a shot at that, too, but we didn't get it very far at it. When I left, when I got my PhD, left MIT, I came to Notre Dame. Salaries were not particularly good then. I needed additional support. I founded a research program funded by the National Science Foundation, focused on particular issues in artificial intelligence, in machine learning. We were working at great length on the mechanical recognition of handwriting, handwritten patterns. Had a group of maybe a dozen people working on this, including engineers and information theorists and the like. One of the primary members of the group was an information theorist named James Massey, who has gone on to make a name for himself worldwide as a information theorist. Under his influence, I became increasingly interested and involved in information theory, technical information theory. I should say in passing that at the end of that 10-year project in mechanical handwriting recognition, we achieved a system that at the time was state of the art. We were actually working on the computer, developing these programs, and the results of that project are published in a journal called Pattern Recognition in the 1973 edition of that. In the course of that study, a problem developed, which I explained at length in the final report. And that problem has come to be known as Serre's paradox. And if you look up Serre's paradox on the internet, you'll find dozens of hits. The paradox generally is that you have to be able to segment a series of letters before you can recognize them individually. Whereas on the other hand, it appears you have to be able to recognize them individually before you can segment them. So Serre's paradox is still part of the contemporary effort in pattern recognition. Mm. The next phase came with during this 10 years period when we were working with actual programs. Part of the group at any rate was working on the computer. I took time to explore other approaches to artificial intelligence and became increasingly interested in the potential of information theory in that regard. Antecedents, people who very much influenced me before this development, were obviously people like Claude Shannon, the communication theorist innovator, people like Nyquist and Hartley that he built on, and a man named Léon Brouillard, who had a thesis that he developed in a very interesting book, that on the basis of thermodynamics, information theory can be developed. I don't do much with that, but the point of mentioning it is that early on, people were beginning to recognize the interaction between thermodynamics and information theory, which is fundamental to cybernetics. Mm-hmm. Culmination of this process, is the book that we have at hand here, Cybernetics and Excellent Philosophy of Mind. And there is a more recent article, lengthy article on cybernetics that's published in the Routledge Kegan Paul volume nine, entitled History of Philosophy volume, entitled The Logic, Mathematics, and Philosophy of Science in the 20th Century. So that pretty much brings us up to date. I should mention finally that in the process of getting oriented in cybernetics as a separate discipline, I was influenced by obvious people like Ashby, and of course, Norbert Wiener, and Jonathan Neumann. So that is how I got to my present interest in cybernetics.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Yeah, wow, all the way your connections to Sage. That's fascinating. I hadn't realized that before you told the story.
Yeah.
So of course we start with Norbert Wiener, as you've mentioned, and of course the title of his landmark book identifies cybernetics as primarily concerned with control and communication. So for you, how are these two aspects related, and in your particular approach, is one more basic than the other?
Very interesting question. The answer to the question is yes. One is more basic. Let me explain. Control has to do with operational systems. What gets controlled are systems that are functioning, that are actually working. And these systems invariably have either a goal to be achieved or a state to be maintained. An example of the former, achievement of a goal, there are many, many examples, but one that was very much in the discussion back then was the interception of incoming aircraft. That was the purpose of the SAGE system, to, when these unfriendlies were coming in, to scramble a bunch of fighters and get up there and intercept them. The system, the SAGE system, was one that had a goal to be achieved. And control was the key word in the process, the description of the process that achieves that goal. An example of the latter, even more familiar, that is, of a state to be maintained, is the control of room temperature by thermostats. That is a control system. The thermostat and the furnace combination is a control system. And the purpose there isn't to achieve a goal, but to maintain a state that's been predetermined as desirable. The variables in this kind of system, the variables that need controlling, as it were, are system states. The control is exercised over the system states to achieve a certain goal or to maintain a certain standard. And this is done by feedback operations. We'll get to feedback later on. On the other hand, communication theory. More often now, or at least in my experience, referred to as information theory. You know, call it communication. It's still called that occasionally, but it's information theory in a technical sense of information, not in the sense of meaning, not in the sense of information revolution or stuff like that, but in the sense of a technical sense of information, which we can get into eventually here. In the communication, information is a characteristic of an information channel consisting of an input and an output and certain statistical interactions between the input and the output. In this information system, input-output system, there's no goal. and there are no protected states. It is not an operating system. Information channel is not an operating system. It is a system for describing and tuning up, getting insight into the interaction among variables in the physical system. So communication theory is not concerned with operating systems. As far as variables are concerned, no system state variables, but rather statistical properties of the input and the output ensembles. The input consists of a variety of possible message states. The output consists of a variety of possible output states at the other end of the channel, so to speak. And information theory has to do with the interaction between those two ensembles of states. Mm-hmm. Early design or early application of information theory. In fact, the main reason that it received funding to be developed had to do with the efficient design of telephone systems. It was developed in Bell Telephone Laboratory. Shannon was worked for Bell Telephone. And modern telephone systems have evolved as a result of insights gained through communication theory. Mm-hmm. Interestingly enough, information theory made possible space exploration. And it did so, I mean, the possibility has two facets. On the one hand, the guidance of the of space probes, for example, or satellite launches, the design is the communication system that makes possible interaction between Earth and these systems in space is a direct application of information theory. Without information theory, this could never have happened to begin with. But there's another interesting facet, another way in which space exploration is dependent upon information theory, and that is in the control of the factors that have to be governed in order to make the space probe possible, make it to guide it, as it were. So here is one sort of early example of the dependency of control of certain sorts of systems, space probes, which depends on information theory. Mm-hmm. Conversely, there is no dependency on the part of information theory upon control theory.
Right.
So that's one indication of how the information theory is more basic. Other respects in which I maintain it's more basic, communication or information theory is more basic. For one thing, communication theory is mathematics. Control theory is engineering, and mathematics is just more basic than engineering. You can do you can't do engineering without mathematics. You can do mathematics without engineering. Another respect in which I maintain communication theory is more basic is that channels of information channels, series, configurations, cascades of information channels can be set up with the following results. Information channels in cascade are known as Markov sources. And what they consist in, what a Markov source amounts to, is the output of one channel serving as the input of another channel, et cetera, et cetera, as long as the cascade is extended. Now, Markov sources are sets of variables, of states, communication signals, states, that serve both as output of one stage and input of the next stage. And the sequence itself, a set of stages with a particular configuration, is called a Markov source. Now, the point here is that Markov sources can be designed in such a fashion as to exhibit feedback characteristics. An example of that is given in the book. I won't attempt to explain it without without diagrams and the like. The point again is that you can design information, cascades of information channels that exhibit feedback. Mm-hmm. Whereas there's no way that you can exhibit, that you can put together a system of control operations that produce information.
Right.
And there's, should we move on?
Sure.
I'm going to mention one more thing, which will give us a point, to give us a chance to move on.
Sure.
And further point there is that information theory contributes significantly to the mind-body problem, whereas control theory has nothing to do with the mind-body problem.
That's
another aspect in which it's more basic.
And here's where your book comes in, of course. And what grabbed me about it right from the get-go was that in your beginning chapter, your book is presented as a contribution to the mind-body problem, the ever bedeviling problem of philosophy and very many related fields. So can you tell us a little bit about the mind-body problem as you understand it going into this book, or it may have shifted between those years and now, and in a brief description, what is the intended contribution to that, to the troubling, puzzling out of that problem of your book?
Yes. There are two aspects to the mind-body problem as I see it. And different people have different views. There's no one thing called the mind-body problem. One is what I call proto-scientific. It's conceptual. The mind-body problem has to do with the basic stuff of which reality is constituted. And there are various views there about the relationship between mind-body and the ultimate stuff. Traditionally, there's dualism, according to which both mind and body are basic. They're not reducible each to the other. With that approach, you have the problem of how they interact. If they're irreducible, how can they interact at all? There's another traditional approach called monism, as against dualism, as against mind-body dualism. Monism has, many different varieties, but one is materialism, according to which only matter exists, and mind somehow or another is a construct based on matter. The alternative to form of monism there is mentalism, according to which the basic stuff is mental in character, and material systems are matter is a construct of mental entities. Examples of the latter well-known in philosophy are Berkeley and Malebranche. And there's a third kind of monism under which mind fits, and that's neutral monism. According to neutral monism, neither mind nor matter is basic. there is another entity that is more basic, neutral as far as mind and matter is concerned, out of which matter can be constructed if it's arranged in one way and mind constructed under other arrangements. And my system is a form of neutral monism. What is monistic, what is the basic stuff in my approach, is information. Mm-hmm. Now, the other side of the mind-body problem is methodological. It so happens, if I read the field right, that there are branches of physical science that don't interact with each other much. Examples would be physics itself and neurophysiology, both physical sciences, but it doesn't help much in neurophysiology to know, be a really expert in physics, and vice versa. They don't interact methodologically. According to the approach that I have been have attempted to develop, all of sciences, physical and mental, are interactive. And the way to sort of illustrate what this means is to think of the evolution of different kinds of systems. At the very basic level, there will be physical systems, such as which seek equilibrium, such as the temperature on the surface of the Earth, which had to reach a certain stability before life could evolve. In the middle level of development, of complexity, I'm putting together a brief list here of systems ordered according to degree of complexity. Mm-hmm. In the middle level of complexity are life systems. Life itself, in the very basic level, the evolution of species, and the evolution of ecosystems, and ultimately of the biosphere itself. That's sort of in the middle level, all having to do with living systems. And then at the higher level, again, as the book is organized, we have individual life forms, species, and individuals within those groups of reproducing organisms that are capable of learning and of what I call consciousness. And the point of this ordering of these systems with respect to increasing complexity is that at any stage, understanding systems on the lower level is a very helpful, if not necessary, factor in understanding systems on the higher level.
Right. So thank you very much for that. It's interesting you mentioned information as the sort of at the core of your monism, and I'm reminded of the comments of a cybernetician I know who was a student of Heinz von Förster's around the time that your book came out, and who said that you know, he'd hoped the promise of cybernetics would be that as physics was the science of matter, that cybernetics would become the science of information and do the same things for information that physics does for matter. So it's interesting to hear something like that, I think, echoed in what you're talking about.
Right.
So a fundamental concept of communication theory is, of course, entropy. And, of course, entropy simultaneously is a basic and major concept in the realm of thermodynamics. And at the center of what your book is doing is bringing these two conceptions of entropy together. So can you tell us a little bit about your view on the relationship between these two entropies in communication theory and in thermodynamics?
Well, that's a very elusive topic. As you know, you'll find many different approaches with many different outcomes. And I will give you my approach, which I have confidence in, still do. Start with thermodynamics, which is perhaps more familiar. Entropy in thermodynamics is degraded structure or expended energy no longer usable for doing work. An example of degraded energy, of course, is low-grade heat. It's warm, but it won't do any work for you. Now, everything about entropy and the laws of thermodynamics is predicated on the notion of a closed system. And it's hard to find physical examples of systems that are entirely closed, but for the conceptual purposes, assume that we're dealing with a closed system. Now, the first law of thermodynamics says that the amount of energy in a closed system is invariable. Same amount of energy throughout time, throughout its evolution or its development. The second law of thermodynamics says that in a closed system, entropy is continuously increasing with time, which means that high-grade structure is being used up, high-grade energy is being consumed, and the end state projected, which, you know, probably will never happen, but the projected end state toward which this process is moving is a universe closed system in which heat is evenly distributed throughout and there's no structure. And that's the end of that's the heat death of the universe, so to speak. Now, back to entropy. It's unusual in the course of natural events to find highly developed systems. Improbable state. It's unusual to find sources of heat or of energy in other forms that are capable of doing work. So the second law of thermodynamics says that these improbable states of high structure and high energy, these improbable states gradually give way to more and more probable states, which is heat evenly distributed and no particular structure. And there is a, well, let me save this for a moment and hop over to the entropy of information theory. In information theory, entropy is a measure of the degree of diversity at the input of the channel. Already one contrast comes up. In thermodynamics, entropy is something that can be measured. In information theory, entropy is not something that gets measured. Instead, it's something that serves as a measure. It measures diversity at the input of the channel. There is a formula, a well-known formula, it takes various forms, for the entropy that gives a mathematical definition of the entropy of a channel source. And that, well, to put it very briefly, entropy, according to this definition, is proportional to the log of the inverse of the probabilities involved. Entropy is proportional to the log of the inverse of probability functions. Whereas in thermodynamics, entropy there is the inverse of the log of the probability of the relevant events. So you have information theory entropy, which is increases with the log of the negative probability, and thermodynamics, where entropy decreases with that function. So they are in some sense opposite. How so? And that's the trick, is explaining how so, how in what respect are they opposite. And for this, and I'll try to do this briefly.
But take your time though, because this is critical to the core of the book. So please take your time.
Indeed it is. The key to relating them comes with Boltzmann's notion of what he calls complexities. Complexities are structures, are entities, are states on the micro level. Complexities are not observable. They are states underlying observable phenomena. What is observable are micro states, what Boltzmann calls the macro level. And I have tried to put together some kind of a conceptual aid in understanding how that works, and I will try it out here. I've never tried it before, but I think it might help. Think of beans in a box. Different number of beans in a given box. There are, different boxes have different number of beans in them. These beans are complexions, Boltzmann's complexions, on the micro level. And the relation between the beans in the box and the box itself is that an increase in number of beans in the box increases the likelihood of its respective box being observed as a macro state. So if you have a box with lots of beans in it, it's highly likely that its corresponding macro state is going to be observable in some relevant context. Whereas if you have less beans in the box, it's less likely to emerge as an observable macro state.
Right.
The most likely distribution across the board is to have the same number of beans in each box. That would correspond to the heat death of the universe, in which there is no structure that is available for doing the world's work, or correspondingly, no energy available for doing the world's work. Mm-hmm. The more unlikely the macro state, that is, the less beans it has in its box, the more unlikely it is, the more improbable it is, and the more improbable it is, the more structure it exhibits for doing work. Okay.
Great.
Now the two entropies.
Mm-hmm.
Thermodynamics. Structure amounts to an improbably small number of beans in the box. And that is convertible into energy. highly improbable arrangement of the micro states here corresponds to energy available for doing work and high structure that can be converted into such energy. And the progression, according to the second law of thermodynamics, is for eventually all the boxes to have the same number of beans in them. Now information theory and entropy there. It is a well-known theorem of information theory that the more probable, the more equal probable, I should say, the more equal probable the events at the input of the system, the more information can be conveyed through that system. So, the state at which entropy, thermodynamic entropy, is greatest is a state in which all the boxes have the same number of beans in them. But in that state, the boxes, the macro states, are all equal probable, which means that when they are entered into the, or when they are available at the input of the information channel, they convey the maximum information. Mm. So the system, the relation of beans and boxes that gives maximum thermodynamic entropy gives minimum information theoretic entropy. And that's why the signs are reversed.
Mm. Great. Thank you for that. And we're going to be moving into neg entropy, of course, which is going to be critical. And your descriptions of negentropic flexibility. But as we en route to those, let's talk a little bit about feedback, because I think one of the many fascinating contributions of the book is you parse the notion of feedback into more categories than the usual distinction of positive negative, and you add at least four other classifications of types of feedback that become very, very important to this notion of negentropic flexibility, particularly as human beings are concerned. So can you tell us a little bit about these several forms of feedback that you've identified and how they bear on the main thrust of the book?
Indeed. The basic forms of feedback are positive and negative. Everybody should eventually come to understand those. And examples of each are well known. Positive feedback. Population increase. More people, the more people are
making
generated.
People. Yeah.
Yeah. Another example is potholes in the road. The bigger the pothole, the more it gets hit by the tires and the bigger it gets. That's positive feedback. Whereas common examples of negative feedback are your thermostat and heat control system. Those are the standard examples. Now, those are all mechanical. In biological systems, you have the same distinction. Another example of positive feedback in biological systems, in addition to exploding populations, is the phenomenon that is so distressing today for many people, which is the richer you are, the richer you get. That's positive feedback. Yeah.
Success to the successful.
The system out of control.
Yeah.
Which is politically notable. As far as negative goes, negative feedback in life systems, all living systems incorporate variables that have to be protected for the system to remain viable. Deviations from those protected variables have to be counteracted. Negative feedback, in broad, is the countering of deviation from those protected variables. Now, moving on from those, that basic understanding of negative and positive, there are the four kinds of feedback that you have referred to that I develop in the book. And the first thing to say about these is that the feedback involved is not unknown at all. People are perfectly aware of it, quite commonplace. The only thing that's new is the names that I've given to them. So I've attempted to define these four different kinds of feedback in ways that will help understand what is happening in given cases of feedback. First is homeostasis, which is a very common, that term is not new, homeostasis. For life systems generally, thinking, for example, just of an individual organism, the system, the organism remains viable only by absorbing negentropy, the absence of entropy from the environment, and discharging the resulting entropy back into the environment. And that transaction, the process of using that negentropy always is less than 100% efficient, which means that more entropy comes out than negentropy goes in. And a system remains viable only insofar as it can keep a balance between what's coming in and what's coming out, a balance that preserves the integrity of its protected variables. Homeostasis, simply put, is countering variation on the part of the protected variables by adjustments internal to the system. An example, control of body temperature. When you get too hot, your sweat glands go into work and so forth. That's an internal adjustment. Another example is maintaining the level of illumination on the retina, which is done by changing the aperture of the lens. Those are internal adjustments, homeostatic. Next step in complexity and effectiveness, which is built on homeostasis. All of these are built on each other progressively. The next step is what I call heterotelic. Hetero for other, telic means aimed at, having to do with adjustments in something outside the system, or more specifically, adjustments in the relation between the system itself and its environment. That's heterotelic. And the key variables are protected by making changes in the environment that tend to make them vary beyond protected levels. Dramatic, in the sense of being quite straightforward, illustration of that is the way a daylily will change its direction of its face to follow the sun. Mm. It maintains its relationship to the sun in such a way that maximum illumination is taken in through the face of the lily. Another example is simple enough, is when an organism touches a hot surface, there's an immediate withdrawal. The organism changes its relationship to the hot surface by reflexive withdrawal. That's heterotelic. Next is sentient feedback, which amounts to advanced detection of threats in the environment to the protected variables. You see them coming and you make adjustments to avoid them. Sentience, you sense what's happening out there and take preventive action.
And this said preventive action can be before it's even impacted the protected variable. Is that true?
The evasive action, yeah, it avoids impact.
Yeah.
Simple example, when a gazelle spots a lion coming over the horizon or something, the gazelle will flee. Mm. That's protection on the basis of sentient feedback. Mm-hmm. And then anticipatory feedback is a further sophistication of sentient feedback amounting to detecting circumstances in advance which are likely to produce threats before the threats appear, and taking evasive action before the threat is actually present. An example is a deer running away when it hears a noise in the woods that sounds like a lion might be present, or more dramatically, for in terms of present examples, an example of anticipatory feedback is when people see forest fire over the hill and leave their homes in advance. They say they protect their essential variables by leaving the scene before the threat develops.
Mm. Or if someone's walking home at night and they see one street is less well lit than another, their avoidance of that street. So,
Yes. And the point overall is that in order of these four different kinds of feedback, the latter are more complex, involve greater commitment of information processing availability in the nervous system than the lower ones.
And then would subsequently provide a greater negentropic flexibility?
Exactly.
Okay, so that takes us to this very important concept. And as you mentioned, those types of feedback that you've named, they're common sense in terms of our everyday explanation, but they haven't been identified as clearly within the theoretical language of cybernetics. And I think it is helpful to have them to have those different types named in that way and get more specific in the ways we sort of slice up that category. And so they provide greater negentropic flexibility, which is a key term in the project of the book. So can you please tell us a little bit about that?
It is a key concept. What negentropic flexibility amounts to is the ability to take in high-grade structure, high-grade energy, over a variety of environmental circumstances. You've got no negentropic flexibility if there's only one rigid set of circumstances in which you can take in the energy that you need and dispel the entropy that you have to get rid of. If there's only one set of circumstances in which that happens, you've got no negentropic flexibility, and very little likelihood of survival. Now, remember entropy and think of negentropy as just the opposite. This term, incidentally, is due to Léon Brunier, whom I mentioned before, negentropy. negentropy is the opposite of high-grade structure. Negentropy is the opposite of degraded structure. It's the opposite of used up heat. In other words, negentropy is the structure existing at a level capable of being converted into usable energy. Or alternatively, negentropy is energy available for doing work. So it's just the opposite of entropy. And this is this concept operates only in thermodynamics. I could have mentioned earlier, and it's interesting, that there is no corresponding concept to the entropy of information theory. There's no neg entropy in information theory.
Mm. Go ahead.
Well, I can continue with the development here, but.
Well, so the negentropic flexibility, obviously, and then on your account is a sign of a more advanced state of evolution. Is that correct to say that increasing negentropic flexibility? And so humans obviously have adapted to have a wide range of different types of circumstances in which we can successfully get the energy we need, etc. And so that's directly then we tie in this idea of negentropic flexibility to the ideas of evolution and behavioral conditioning and learning and consciousness itself. So all these adaptive processes, you remark on their similarities in a way. So can you comment a little bit on the way these adaptive processes are similar? As I mentioned, evolution, behavioral conditioning, consciousness, how these are all on a kind of continuum for you in the account you give in the book.
Yes. Leading into that, let me just summarize aspects of this negentropic flexibility concept.
Sure.
The more complex a system, a living system, the more negentropy is needed to maintain it in a viable condition, and the more entropy has to be discharged in order for it to become glutted, to avoid becoming glutted with entropy. And the biosphere at large is an organization of systems that are ordered with degree to complexity. Each level within the biosphere being the system of life on surface of the Earth overall, which is built up out of many levels of less complex structure. And each level is more complex than any of the levels beneath it. So stability of a living system that requires a certain amount of energy and entropy disposal capacity depends upon the number of systems underneath it that can provide it with those resources. So we got a set of ordered set of systems, each level of which is more complex than the levels beneath it, and each level of which depends upon the support of the levels beneath it. And just as a wrap-up of that, another matter very, very much contemporary concern today, that the threat to continued existence of the human species depends upon the integrity of those systems in the biosphere underneath it. And we are destroying systems that provide negentropic flexibility that's needed for support of human life. That's sort of the degradation of this relationship. Now, the question having to do with evolution and learning has to do with the building up of those structures. Evolution is the development of reproductive groups or species that can make homeostatic adjustments to the living conditions under which to which they are subjected. And these homeostatic adjustments are could be exemplified in many, many different forms it takes. But one is simply changing in food sources, changing in type of food that the organism relies on, or change in locales in which these resources are available. Evolution of species is a matter of reproductive groups building up capacities of negentropic flexibility that give them, that maintain them, that give, that provide viability over a wide range of environmental circumstances. Now that's evolution of reproductive groups having to do with evolving more effective capacities of negentropic flexibility. Learning, in turn. Learning has to do with adjustment of behavior patterns of the involved organism that keep it in contact with its environment in a way that provides the needed resources of negentropy. In some very famous this would get too detailed. Let me just skip on a bit here. Learning occurs with the adaptation of connections between sensory organisms and sensory organs and effector organisms, connections that provide effective response to environmental threats or environmental contingencies. What's evolving there is the connection between the input and the output, which is obviously a physiological connection. And organisms change those connections with change in the circumstances that they hope to cope with, that they have to cope with. I attempt to elucidate both operant and Pavlovian conditioning on the basis of this model. But in general, learning is a behavioral condition of behavioral evolution of nervous connections that will increase your ability to cope with the environment. And then consciousness. I should add here that my concept of consciousness is taken over from a book I wrote even earlier than the Cybernetics book called Consciousness. And it was an analysis of conscious mental states on the basis almost exclusively of information theory. Now, here's how consciousness of that sort works. And this is in by way of replacement, in place of the kind of neuronal connection between input and output that is exhibited in lower species. When I was writing the cybernetics book, the experiments at MIT with frog receptors. Mm-hmm. We're very much in the air, very, very current. And the frog has a number of connectors, a number of neurophysiological connections between input and output, each of which is dedicated to a particular kind of pattern at the input. One example is what is called a net conflict, a net convexity pattern. When a certain shape appears in the environment of the frog, that has, that we would describe as the appearance of a fly in tongue shot range, then the frog automatically exhibits the kind of behavior that will hopefully result in capturing the fly. And that's a dedicated pathway. And there are maybe five or six different pathways of that sort that the authors describe, each of which is dedicated. Now, it is a basic theorem of information theory. Actually, it's called Shannon's 10th theorem, according to which, when you combine channels, make them interactive, more information can be conveyed. More information is conveyed by two channels together than the sum of what would be conveyed of those two channels separately. Mm-hmm. You get greater information capacity by combining channels. And consciousness is a matter of combining channels in that way. And this occurs, and I will just run through this quickly, hoping it's basically intelligible. This occurs over a series of separate information channels. You can divide the processing that goes on between the retina and the upper cortex, divided into chunks of information processing, each of which feeds into the next. And at each stage, certain processes take place that simplify the patterns that are being developed on the lower stage.
Mm-hmm.
Various ways of removing redundancy, for example, of summarizing, so that at each stage, the set of patterns that are being processed are more and more simplified and more efficient until you get to the upper level that feeds into the cortex itself, where you have a stable pattern that has been evolved to meet certain conditions. And the basic conditions that it has to meet is that the pattern that emerges has to exist in a high degree, a high level of negentropic overlap with the patterns in the environment to which the organism is responding. So what you have in effect is a series of channels engaged in simplifying processes that result in patterns on the level of the cortex, which feed into the organism's effector mechanism. Patterns that exist in high level of neutral information with patterns exposed at the sensory periphery. And that evolves in a way that is covered by the feedback processes that were talking about before. Mm-hmm. And the net result is an organism working with patterns that have been processed to provide the greatest amount of mutual information relevant to the environmental circumstances the organism has to cope with. So that's an information theory treatment of consciousness.
Mm-hmm. And of course, all of these things you've described and their evolutionary advances, so to speak, then of course they spread out through the development of social structures, language, reasoning, and you continue in the book along through the continuing sort of wave following along as these negentropic advantages to negentropic flexibility continue to accrue and grow, but we'll have to leave it to readers to discover that when they read the book. As we are running short of time, we're already over time, and you've been very, very generous with your time. Before we get to our final question about sort of what's on your mind these days, I did want to talk about one last thing, which is because, of course, when you wrote this back in the 70s, and it is now something that does not seem nearly as fantastical as it might have when you first put it forward in the book. When you expound upon the notion that as an information structure, the human subject might be capable of immaterial existence. So if indeed what we have here is a kind of informational monism, this idea that the human subject does not necessarily have to be rendered materially, which has been an implicit idea in cybernetics, even going back to Ashby to some degree. You can sort of read between the lines and find it. And now, of course, this idea of uploading consciousness, etc., is something that's actually seriously being talked about. And you were exploring it as a potential consequence of this informational monism back in the 70s. Is there anything else you want to say about that notion?
A couple of things. At that point, there was a particular movie that was very much a matter of discussion. People were sort of excited about it. It was called The Fly. Mm-hmm. Have you heard of The Fly?
Oh, yes.
Anyway,
yes, indeed.
the plot of the movie is that what is unique and functional about a given individual is being converted into digital form and is going to be transmitted someplace. And in the process of recording this information, a fly got in the way. And the fly got encoded as part of the informational structures characteristic of the individual person involved, so that when it was materialized at the other end of the system, the fly became dominant, and you had a fly man. Well, information in the process of being transmitted that way is immaterial. That this is what is being processed, it's in immaterial form. And if the characteristics of a given human individual that are essential to his or her identity can be digitalized in this way, they can be present in immaterial form, in the form of something like a Markov chain. You've got this system of mathematically describable states, which itself contains information. And if the information essential to a given human being can be encoded in the form of Markov chains, then you've got immaterial existence.
Do you think it's something that we will achieve over the course of this century?
No.
How long will it take us? Are we going to get there?
I'm not sure we want to get there.
Well, yeah, that's another question, isn't it? But obviously an important one. Well, yeah. Thank you so much. You've been so generous with your time. Our traditional last question, as with all the channels on the network, is what are you working on now? I know you're a professor emeritus of philosophy at Notre Dame. Are you still writing? Are you still researching any particular topics right now? Or what is on your mind these days?
What is on my mind these days is a large set of philosophic issues that I didn't have time to pay much attention to while I was working officially. Many, many questions. One of them, the nature of time, for example. Another, the nature of personal identity, for another example, which can be approached in ways other than based on information theory. The nature of self-awareness and numerous associated issues, which it turned out all sort of interact, which is interesting in itself. So I guess you might say that what I have been doing since I retired is approaching some of these same issues, particularly having to do with human identity and immaterial existence from aspects other than technical information theory.
Great. Well, we wish you all the best with all of your future endeavors. And again, it's been a great pleasure for me to get a chance to talk to you. The reissue of this book was a real revelation to me. I think it's a magnificent kind of field unifying book in that it provides a really robust account of the sort of fundamentals of cybernetics as you found them, so to speak, and then your contribution, again, parsing the different types of feedback, discussing negentropic flexibility, and positing this informational monism, I think are really powerful things that add a great deal to the field. And we're just so lucky that Rutledge was wise enough to reissue the book, and that we were lucky enough to be able to spend this time with you in conversation. So, Dr. Kenneth Sayre, thank you again very, very much for your time and for joining us.
You're most welcome, and I'm grateful for the opportunity to do this. And as a final word, I would like to thank you for some very stimulating questions, but even more for your manifest understanding of what I was saying, because it's not simple. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.